Well, welcome. Thank you for inviting me. And it's the first time here to this this centre. I walked straight past it the first time because it doesn't quite grab on from the street. You know,
No.
But it's nice to find its little haven of Hindu studies in Oxford. So, yes, introductions. Let's just go around and introduce ourselves, okay? So I'm Thomas Daffin. I'm a philosopher and comparative religionist. And I've been specialising in peace studies. I run this Institute of Peace Studies and Global Philosophy that's up on the thing, which arose out of a feasibility study for the University of London to create a Centre for Peace Studies. And, you know, it's still going. London University keeps changing its structure and colleges drop in and out, so I haven't managed to actually find a college stable enough to actually do anything with. And also the politics of academia is just a joke. Respect. I'm sure it's not here in this illustrious institute, but so I just meanwhile get on with the work, you know. And I ended up doing seminars in the House of Lords because at least I thought that was a stable enough institution. However, recent events have possibly disproved that, given that the Lords seem to have forgotten what they're there for.
Right.
So anyway, do introduce yourself, and then we'll start. Yeah.
Sure. My name is Elizabeth Marino. I'm a PhD student in sociocultural anthropology at the University of Alaska, actually.
Oh, wow.
And I study climate change issues dealing with Inuit people that are trying to relocate because of some severe erosion and flooding and their sort of interactions with the state and federal governments in that process.
Oh,
so it's not quite in line with peace studies, but
mm.
I can see how conflict
yeah,
could erupt in these sorts of situations. Mm. And I'm here taking a course at Oxford Brookes on disasters and disasters and aid. And so I just saw it listed, this lecture today, and it looked interesting to me, so I came down.
Hi, my name is Brainerd, and I'm doing a PhD program at the Oxford Centre for Mission Studies,
okay.
Based here. And I'm working on an Indian thinker and philosopher called Sri Aurobindo,
okay.
A late 19th and early 20th century
right.
thinker. But my interest in this is with regard to the communal violence that's been happening
yeah.
in India, especially
yeah.
in the last couple of decades, and especially in 2008.
Yeah.
So between ethnic conflicts and communal violence.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, welcome. Yeah.
Yeah. My name is Kathal Sair. Anu is what my friends call me. I'm also a PhD student at the Oxford Centre for Mission Studies. I come from Northeast India, Nagaland.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing research on the whole question of forgiveness and reconciliation in my own context of a lot of political violence and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
So yeah, there were some bombings recently, weren't there, in the capital a few months ago?
That's in Assam, that's our neighbour.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. You're further north. That,
yeah, further north and further east.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So I'm Gavin Flood. I'm the academic director of the Oxford Centre for Indian Studies, with interest in comparative religion and Shaivism.
Right. Well, there we are. So now let me just—I'll just sort of introduce myself a bit more in depth to give you the background of how I got doing peace studies and conflict resolution work in relation to philosophy. I've been interested in Eastern religions and Buddhism and Hinduism and stuff from quite early on, and read philosophy at the University of Bristol, but mostly read outside the curriculum because it was a traditional academic Western biased philosophy course, and but I'd already got interested in Buddhist philosophy through my work with Chogyam Trungpa and the Vajrayana tradition of Tibet. And obviously that was inspired by the monasteries of Nalanda and the Tantric tradition going north into Tibet. So it's really, you know, a branch of Indian studies, really, that sort of ancient Buddhist teachings. And I remember reading Heinrich Zimmer and his work on Indian art and stuff. That inspired my imagination very early on. And by reading Carl Jung, who seemed to have a much more open mind than most Western thinkers to Eastern thought, again was inspired by his work. So I basically spent some time at Bristol studying philosophy. Then I went to Canada independently at the University of Calgary and I'm Canadian by birth. So I spent 4 years studying world religions and philosophy independently as a private scholar, reading the sacred texts of all the faiths as a private sort of tapas, if you want to use a Hindu term, you know. And that was my first encounter with, you know, the Quran, the Bible, and the great, you know, texts of all the other faiths. And but I was kind of looking as a philosopher, trying to see what's common to all these things, you know. Eventually, anyway, I came back to Britain and worked at the University of London. I graduated this time in history because I wanted to know more about contemporary conflicts, global conflicts, politics, East-West, you know, diplomacy, the Cold War, that kind of stuff. And and I'd launched a group of philosophers looking at peace issues, which there's a load of stuff on the web about this, and I can't, you know, if you Google on it, it sort of turns up. But so in the 80s, we used to have meetings in London looking at East-West politics of peace. And in 1990, I found myself in Moscow talking to Russian philosophers about, you know, the then raging Cold War and whether there's a possibility of spiritual disarmament, sort of intellectual reconciliation, like you're talking about. Can we come off our high horses of our different cultures and stuff? I'd also been a student of yoga, and I suppose the kind of philosophy that was inspiring all this work was kind of perennial philosophy, you know, all this Huxley type of Vedantic kind of concepts and so on. I was also, which I find reflected in every tradition. So I'm also an Anglican. I love the Christian tradition as well. I don't have a problem. For me, Christ is a universal teacher, and I will sit at his feet, you know, as much as Buddha or anyone else. Ended up, anyway, to cut a long story short, working for the University of London to set up this Peace Studies Institute. Travelled about 30 countries around the world, interviewing people about how they educate for peace in their education system. So I went to the States on a study tour, went to Harvard, San Francisco, you know, talking to university professors and also school teachers in the school system. Do they educate, you know, in peace education in some way? And did a training in San Francisco as a mediator, which was, you know, the Americans have pioneered mediation as a practical tool for conflict resolution, right? Often the Quakers. And I worked in a school in Brooklyn with a black educator who'd worked with Martin Luther King, who was now running a peace mediation team in this school in, you know, New York. And obviously the schools were pretty tough there. Knives, guns coming into school. They had things on the door, you know, to search you, x-ray type things. And this was back in the early 90s. I ended up working in Southwark in Peckham, introducing the first mediation program into British schools, training kids as mediators and stuff. Was also working as Secretary General of a thing called the World Conference on Religion and Peace, which WCRP, if you haven't heard of it, it's the biggest interfaith peace group on the planet, based in New York. And that took me to Rome in 1996 with the former Pope in, you know, sort of presiding. I don't know where it's gone here. It's there. They've got their own website. I'm not quite sure why they're not showing it. But so, you know, 900 religious leaders in Rome at the Vatican. And sort of the buck stops there, you know. These were senior religious leaders from all over the planet, including Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Jewish, Islam, the whole lot, in 96. And I was there as a lay philosopher, whatever, you know. So the question then is, what can we do as religious leaders about the situation of the planet? That was the time the Balkan Wars breaking out. I think, you know, Yugoslavia was falling apart at the seams, and a lot of it over religion. So I got the idea, well, what we can do is set up a mediation service that draws on religious expertise. And you can have like a standing committee of theologians and spiritual experts and wisdom teachers, elders from each faith community, Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, whatever, ready at a phone call's notice to fly into country X, which is falling apart because of religious violence. So I thought this was a good idea. You know, like, why don't we have it already? It's so obvious, right? And so I managed to work with a bunch of interfaith leaders. And we did a training for this thing in Oxford, actually, in 96. 30 people came representing the different faith communities of the planet. And we had somebody from everywhere. And we set up this thing here called the Multi-Faith and Multicultural. Now, why hasn't that come? You're supposed to click on that, and then the website's just being updated at the moment. Yes, it's playing silly. Anyway, normally, this thing is currently being updated. Normally you click on there and it comes up. So I'm sorry about that. There may be something there. Anyway, it's called the Multi-Faith and Multicultural Mediation Service. Right? And it's been in existence since 97. And we've taken on about 20 different cases concerning religious disputes, okay, which have taken me to... One of them, the most, well, they're all interesting. Some, you know, it can be at the micro level, like racial violence in schools in London. A Persian teacher was being racially abused by other staff, by kids, all kinds of politics, you know. And that was a case that we took on. Right up to, I don't know if you recall, but there was a huge dispute within the Tibetan Buddhist community when the Dalai Lama outlawed the worship of Dorje Shugden. And you had the NKT on the one hand, pro Dorje Shugden worship, sort of old tantric deity, and then the Dalai Lama's lot saying, no, this was black magic and you shouldn't do it. And it came to blows, and there were placard waving, all kinds of stuff. And that dispute was referred to our mediation service, and I went and interviewed all the relevant players, and went to Dharamsala as well. And that's an ongoing case, I mean, it's not resolved fully. And it's very interesting dealing with religious disputes because, gosh, it can involve all kinds of like worldviews, cosmological battles. This particular one involves reincarnational battles, you know, because we're talking Dalai Lamas here. So it's stuff they did in a former life. The other lot haven't forgiven them for, you know, because I don't know if you know the story, but apparently a former Dalai Lama had Dorje Shugden killed. He was a Tibetan monk who was more successful as a teacher than the Dalai Lama, and out of pique, the then Dalai Lama had him assassinated, and he then started haunting the Potala. And the only way to placate him was then to institute the worship of Dorje Shugden as a bodhisattva, which then placated this wrathful deity, and then he's ever since, there's been a little niche in every Tibetan household to this angry deity. So it's a teaching about the fallibility of Dalai Lamas. Even they suffer from jealousy and stuff. But so when the current Dalai Lama abolished it, they all said, no, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. So that was a really interesting case. And that sort of ticks away that thing. Meanwhile, I started working for the Gandhi Foundation out of a building in East London, Kingsley Hall, and running a school of nonviolence, which is still a live project. Unfortunately, the people I worked with at the Gandhi Foundation have died and moved on. They were sort of elderly sages, you know, who knew Gandhi and stuff. But the trouble is, if you work with the older folks, they die off. So it's, but you know, one carries on with the work. So that's a bit about my background. I'm also a teacher, and I've been head of religious studies in several schools, grammar school. One of my students is currently doing theology here, so I was hoping he might be here today, but you've not heard from Alex ever?
No.
No, okay. He's in his first year here. So that's the kind of overview, background, right? Specifically, I want to talk about India a bit now, and the idea of like applying the theory of peace and conflict resolution to the Indian context. Because obviously, the recent terrorist attacks in Mumbai are sort of still fresh in one's minds, and India you know, there's the ongoing problem of Kashmir. So there's and in, you know, the northeastern region where you're from, there's been attacks and stuff. So there's a kind of simmering cauldron of unresolved conflicts and tensions there. My question is, as a philosopher, as a religious studies expert, you know, what can I do? What can we do? What can places like this school of Hindu studies do? You know, and I think there is something we can do, and I think there's we can make genuine contributions, you see, as scholars. So let me tell you about how I got involved in it and why, and what perspective I'm coming from. I've been to India 4 times on sort of educational visits, pilgrimages. Most recently, I was invited by a Jain organisation called the Anuviva organisation, whose website is there now. They're based in Rajasthan, and they have some fascinating projects that they're doing. This thing, the 7th IPNA, is the thing I went to, which is a conference on peace. And okay, so this is the chap who's running it, Acharya Mahapragya. And there were about 500 people at this conference, including a former president of India, the only Muslim president, so far as I know, who had written a book with Mahapragya on sort of global futures. This former president is a scientist and a space scientist who designed the Indian space program before he became president, which is rather ironic. So in effect, he's designed the rockets that would carry India's nuclear warheads into action if they ever launched, you know, an operation. But he's a really lovely chap, sort of white-haired, retired scientist, who's genuinely committed to peace dialogue and education. So I met him, you know, and also there was the governor of Rajasthan, who's a Sikh, who I sat next to, and we both gave speeches. And then I ran a kind of workshop on conflict resolution and peace and mediation and stuff. And this was just a few weeks before the Mumbai thing. This is in November. The Jains, of course, have a tradition of ahimsa, non-violence. They take it to, you know, considerable degree of dedication. For instance, they won't travel. This is for the monks who are dedicated to the religious life. They won't travel on cars or trains because it might damage creatures. They will walk on foot. And these particular, the hierarchy of the Jains is the further you've walked barefoot, the more holy you are. If you've done like 20,000 miles, you're a novice. Some of these guys have done like 100,000 miles on foot, and then they're about 80 by then. And then at the end of their life, they're carried. You know, but I mean, and this is what inspired Gandhi with his salt march and stuff, this tradition of walking for peace. The former head of this organisation was called Acharya Tulsi, who got involved. He became a Jain monk in the 20s, and he personally has known all the former presidents of India. Way back in the 50s, I think, he walked into the Punjab when it was on a flashpoint, and sort of spoke to the religious leaders on both sides, you know, Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, whatever, and just made them stop. He was an amazing chap. I met him right at the end of his life, the first time I went to this Jain. They have a university in a place called Ladnan, which is just outside Jaipur. They also have this wonderful thing called Children's Peace Palace, which is a facility for, it's a museum basically, for kids to do educational work. These are photographs of it. It's their headquarters. And it's unlike any museum I've ever been in. It has like models in different yoga poses. So it's like, this is the asana or whatever, you know, and it has people modelling it. Because they practice a particular form of yoga in this group. They've developed teachings about meditation, spirituality. Now, the thing about the Jains, philosophically, it's very interesting. is to do with what they call Anikant Vada. I don't know if you're familiar with that concept. It means the many-sidedness of views, right? It's a thing in Jain metaphysics, and it's spelt Anikant Vada. Let me see if I can bring up a thingy here, and I'll just type it in. And it means there's no one truth. And Jain metaphysics, therefore, is premised on the concept of multiplicity of perceptions. There's no final or ultimate truth. Oh, God. This is ridiculous. No, I don't really want to. I just want to type a word in. Do you mind? Yeah, I accept that. That's fantastic. Anikant Vada, right? And it's traditionally interpreted as the many-sidedness of views. Okay. And what's extremely interesting in the history of philosophy is that this notion is very, very ancient in Jainism, right? And it applies to things like discussions about the nature of deity, the nature of the soul, all epistemological problems in philosophy and so on. They'll say, well, that's partly right, and then the opposite is equally partly right. So the affirmation of the existence of one God, yeah, that would be affirmed by Jain thinkers, but so is simultaneously and equally the affirmation of the non-existence of one God, because you can see it from both sides, and both present themselves to the human mind as logically plausible, right? You could argue, no, there's a Trinitarian position, there's three gods in one, like the Christian theology, and the Jains would say that's perfectly plausible, that is also true, right? Or you could say, like a Zoroastrian, there's a dualism, there's two gods. That's also true. Or you could say there's an infinity of gods, like Hinduism. That's also true. What? How can they both be true? You know, and the Jains say, Anikant Vada, this is just the way things are. It's a bit like Kant saying there are these fundamental antinomies in the human mind, which we cannot resolve through pure logic. Okay? So they say, don't bother, don't try, suspend judgment. Okay? And meanwhile, practice the spiritual path. Non-violence, you will then reach a plane of enlightenment where you will paradoxically be able to resolve all the views, right? And you will attain a state of actual peace, right? So and this whole notion of suspending of judgment we call epoche, which is underlying the phenomenological approach of Husserl and all the rest of it, right? This is now what's so interesting, right, is that as I discovered when I went and talked to these people and researched my history and all that, is that Pyrrho of Elis is reputed to have introduced epoche and skepticism into Western philosophy, right? In ancient Greece. Pyrrho was the guy who invented this notion of suspension of judgment, because he said, we don't need to make final ultimate decisions about, you know, whether Zeus is real or just a story. Whether, you know, Persian gods are real or just some sort of myth. We can't know. So let's just do epoche and practice the virtuous life as philosophers. And then, you know, kind of it won't be so important, because much more important is to learn to live in harmony, you know, practicing philosophy. And this notion then was transmitted on by Cicero into Western European tradition, and it underlied the work of the academic school under Carneades, and it came into it was revived in the 12th century with Abelard. You know, see things from both sides, yes and no. Formation of the University of Paris owed itself to this revived notion, and Oxford itself, and the whole definition of what we call an academic, right, someone that sees things in depth from both sides and doesn't make a kind of final ultimate decision, I realise with great glee, we owe to the ancient Indian thinkers, particularly the Jains, because Pyrrho travelled to India with Alexander the Great and met Gymnosophists, they're called, which means ancient Jain sages or Hindu sages or some kind of yogis who taught him this notion of anekamphada. So I thought this is very interesting when I discovered this. You know, this is the origin of academic methodology, right? And it goes back to ancient India. But it only works if you also practice nonviolence simultaneously, right? Because you need, you know, there's no point sort of pretending epoké and then secretly stabbing the other guys in the back, you know, which is sadly what some forms of Western academia do. You know, they pretend they're suspending judgment, but actually they're siding. And there are some people that would say the BBC's supposed impartiality thing, actually they're pretending to be impartial, but actually by not showing their ads, they're actually taking sides. So this is politically charged, what I'm talking about here. What is impartiality? What is objectivity? Well, I'm biased in favour of nonviolence, like the Indian philosophical tradition. And I believe that if you're going to go for genuine epoké, genuine suspension of judgment, and anekamphada, you have to also adopt nonviolence and peace at the centre of your philosophical stance, you see. So that's that's kind of where I'm coming from. Let me just say a bit more about my other trips around India. A couple of times I've been to the Jain communities of Rajasthan. I've also been down in the south, Bangalore, and met Sai Baba and went to the sort of ashram there and you know, talked to many of the devotees. And I went to Auroville and researched, you know, in great detail Aurobindo's work and know his work considerably, and went to the ashram there. And also to his, you know, his place of samadhi and so on, where his body was, and have a lot of time for Aurobindo. And I went to a big conference in 1993 in Bangalore of world religious leaders, looking for, you know, common ground. And that was the time of the World Parliament of Religions, which was restarted in Chicago in 1993. And it's been meeting every 5 years ever since. The next meeting will be in Melbourne. And if you Google that in, it's coming up in 2009. And where I just got back from India, the deputy director of that body was there speaking about the conference that's coming up. And it's going to be focused on Indigenous people's rights, Indigenous religions. The Aboriginals are very involved in Australia. Your Inuit could send a representative. They want Indigenous religions to go from all over the planet, as well as the other religions. You know. So that's going to be a good one.
That's interesting. When is that?
World Parliament of Religions. And it's coming up in Melbourne. And they're talking about all aspects of, interfaith harmony, sort of thing I'm talking about here, really. I also went to Tiruvannamalai, to the ashram of Sri Ramana Maharshi, great Hindu sage, who was active in the early part of the 20th century, died in the early 60s, I think. And that's a beautiful experience as well. And that's connected with this hill of Arunachala, which is where Shiva is supposed to have come to earth, manifested. So we're talking about the Shaivite traditions of southern India there. And he identified, he was... You know, well, all the Hindu sages are Shiva. You know, Sai Baba is Shiva to his devotees. Ramana Maharshi was. You know, we are. You know, it's endless, really. And I love the story of the endless column of fire, when the three deities dispute as to who is the one, and it turned out to be the column. You know. I talked about the Multi-Faith and Multicultural Mediation Service, which was launched in 96 after this conference at the Vatican. And more recently, just to say that the real challenge for religious groups on the planet, I know there are religious conflicts in many parts of the world, but the epicentre, I think, is the Middle East. Right? That's where the sort of great three monotheistic religions seem to be hurling bombs and rockets and verbal abuse at each other. So I've got active in the last period focusing on that, and I've launched, if it comes up, a thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Middle East, which has got the acronym TRCME. No, nothing's coming up. I think this site is being worked on as we speak, because all these sites, typical, isn't it? Okay, I assure you it's there. And basically what happened is, in August this last year, 2008, I went to Israel and Palestine with a camera, and I filmed 30 interviews with religious thinkers and so on, of which I think there is something on this thing, holisticchannel.org.uk, if we're lucky, and it's working. Right, this is sort of holistic television channel that's on broadband. You can do stuff. And they came with me to Israel and Palestine and filmed me interviewing. There it is. So this thing, you can, if all goes well, you click on it. This is a trailer. It's only 11 minutes. I'm not going to play the whole thing. And we interviewed, for instance, that Al-Lakar Center for Religious Studies in Bethlehem is where they're doing encounter between Christianity and Islam and Judaism. I interviewed this guy, Cherise Khoury, who's a theologian. He's an amazing bloke. He's a Catholic. He's from the Palestinian Roman Catholic community. I learned through him that in about the 1700s, a number of Palestinians who had been Orthodox Christians, you know, and they have their own sort of heritage, they accepted Rome's suzerainty, and this sort of brought access to all kinds of not least academic openings for them. And so this guy's got he's got two doctorates, one from the Gregorian University in Rome on a 8th century Christian theologian in Palestine who already was arguing for reconciliation between Islam and Christianity, and saying that we've got a few disputes about, you know, was Christ the only son of God and what does that mean? But let's forget that, because 99% of what we believe in is common. This is a Christian theologian saying that. And so what he's looking at is examples of Islamic, Christian, Jewish harmony and symbiosis and so on. And that's what this Al-Lakar Center does in Bethlehem. Wonderful stuff. So I also spoke to a Lutheran pastor who's an Arab Christian theologian who's launched a kind of Arab liberation theology. It's not often spoken about. We all know about the Latin American liberation theology. There's another one in the West Bank alive and kicking of Arab Christian theologians who are saying we're in the actual living lineage of Christ here. You know, this is our homeland, we are Christians, because, you know, probably some of these guys are related to Christ, do you know what I mean, biologically. And they know, they feel that, you sense that. And they really genuinely want to live in peace. I interviewed at some length the director of the Bethlehem Center for, Palestinian Center for Nonviolence and Conflict Resolution, a guy called Dr. Zugbi Al-Zugbi, who's a Palestinian Christian, been in Bethlehem, his family, for 500 years and more. Amazing guy. He's got a master's degree in peace studies from the States. He's married to an American. They're counselling traumatised children who have been caught up in the violence. Something like 70% of Palestinian children have nightmares and need psychiatric help and so on. You know, they're trying to help. I filmed all that in August, and if you click on there, you can see it. But, of course, that was even before this recent outbreak of fighting in Gaza. And I did interview a Sufi Muslim chap in the Galilee who was at first quite suspicious of me. Sort of West, you know, he thought I worked for intelligence or I was some kind of political, what was I doing, did I know Tony Blair? You know, he wouldn't talk to politicians at all. He hated them, wherever they're from. He was a spiritual man. And when he realised I was a philosopher and, you know, wasn't working for any government agencies and things, he then came clean and we talked and he swore eternal blood brotherhood and stuff. And he said he would introduce me to his Sufi sheikh, who lives in Gaza. But I can imagine he's not very happy now, because the poor old Sufi sheikh's probably been bombed, you know, and it's just absolute catastrophe what's happened there, in my opinion. So that's my ongoing work, and I'm running this thing, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Middle East. You know, I was planning to go to Israel and Palestine and Gaza and Egypt this coming August. I still intend to, you know, and I think it's necessary that you know, people do this kind of work in that region. But on my way back through the Balkans, this was the time when the Georgian War was going on, and you know, it's like working for peace sometimes on this planet feels like the finger in the dike. You know, you've got, you're dealing with one problem, something starts leaking over there, right? So suddenly the Caucasus start going up in flames, right? And Russia was sending tanks in, and you know, South Ossetians, and everybody claiming the other guys have started it, you know. So I thought, I got this very clear idea. I was in Athens at the time, finishing a novel. And I just was reveling in European culture, you see. I just felt how civilized this place is. Not knowing that a few months later Athens would go up and, you know, stone throwing madness as well. But I came back through the Balkans and ended up in Venice, and I was going around the Doge's Palace in Venice. If you've not been, do go, it's a superb place. And there's these rooms upstairs that Venice used to like rule the Orient in terms of trade, right? But not only that, they sent merchants to the Americas, to China, or to the Indies, in fact. And there's this incredible hall where they have these vast maps of the world in great detail. Has anyone been there? Well, you must go, right? And these maps are each at least the size of that entire wall, right? Sort of higher up. And that's just like the Caspian Sea region. There's another one that big, but sort of twice as wide, which would be for the Americas. And then another one for the East Indies and so on. And they're incredibly accurate. And they were produced in about 1300-1400. And their merchants used to travel. And it was extraordinary being there. And I thought, I mean, there's a lot of experience here in you know, on world issues. So I got the idea, the European Union should set up a formal mediation service dealing with conflicts, either between member states or on its borders, like in Georgia, and indeed in the Middle East, Israel, Palestine. It's kind of Mediterranean countries. So I'm working now, again, if the website was working, I would click at this point and it would say European Union Mediation Service. Of course, it doesn't. So I apologise about that. But no, it just comes up with this thing again. So anyway, I've been in touch with the formal channels of the European Union to get this thing established. And I've written a document which is being sent to the European Union Commission President Barroso and to the then head of the European Union, who was Sarkozy. And it's interesting that they have been trying in their own way to kind of mediate the Middle East problem. Sarkozy flew into Egypt to deal with the Gaza thing. They both tackled the problem of Ukraine and the gas flow, which was the sort of thing I'm saying we need a European Union mediation service for. Like suddenly Russia turns off the taps because the gas is, you know, not being paid for by Ukraine, and then suddenly half of Europe starts freezing, you know. So that's what I'm saying, is that we shouldn't just leave it to ad hoc heads of government to negotiate that as and when it comes up, but they should have a backup team, European Union Mediation Service, of professional mediators on call, and even being preemptive, seeing where the likely flashpoints are coming up ahead of time and trying to sort them. You know, a team of dedicated diplomats, really. Boring people in suits, right? Germans and things. And the theory is that any conflict, you know, break out in Europe, you'd send in these Germans and Belgians and French, and they'd bore them to death. They, you know, they would refuse to go away until they resolved the conflict, you see, with their clipboards and, you know, all that stuff. And then the people would just say, look, go away, we'll make peace just to get rid of you. Because, I mean, I find European bureaucracy and all the gobbledygook totally unreadable. Can you imagine whole waves of that coming at you if you start doing war? You know? And also you could use a bit of bribery. You could offer them, like, we'll put some money in a pot, a couple of million quid, and we'll let you have every month, you know, a part of it, as long as you stop fighting. You know, pay for peace. I mean, it's in the interests of Europe to do that. That's what I'm arguing. So anyway, I thought that's a good idea, and it's in the pipeline, and it's going on. And if you read in the papers 2 or 3 years from now it's been set up, you heard it here for the first time. But then I went back to India, and then India was falling apart with all these conflicts, right? And this is when all the fightings break out in your part, up in the northeast and things. And I went to this recent conference, and I thought, well, actually, why don't we export this idea of a European Union mediation service, which would be a governmental body, an official intergovernmental body, into the Indian context itself? And so I came up, you know, thinking aloud with these colleagues who are at the conference, I came up with this proposal, which I'm hoping I can find, if I'm lucky, on a website to show you. So it's international peace and conflict.org. That's on this website, so you can, I can give you a photocopy of it, or you can look at it when you get home. Now this is quite a good site, run from the States. A guy called Craig Zelliger runs the Master of Arts at Georgetown University. You can sign up and get a kind of you know, you build your own little page there. Let me see. No, hang on, I'm already a member. I don't want to sign up for it. I want to log in. That's what I'm trying to do here.
Can I take this?
Members?
Yeah. Blogs. What does it say? Members. Maybe that's for me.
Sign in. There's a
sign
in on the right hand side.
Oh, is there a sign in?
Yeah.
Where's that one?
On the right hand side. You need to. Sign up or sign in below.
Where? Oh, I see. Sorry. Sign in. Yeah. Right now. There we are. Okay. Right. Presumably, they will recall me. I sign in. Not particularly. Not now. No, I don't seem to be on there. Oh yeah, there I am. Thomas Dufflin, right. Excellent. And I've got 15 messages, how exciting. Right. Okay, so this is a sort of blurb about me. And what you do is you get feedback and stuff, right? And this is with other conflict experts around the world. I write beautifully, that guy says, that's very nice. Here it is. What I did, when I came back from India, I got so excited about this, November 2008, I posted the text, right? Because it's got, this thing's got like 20,000 members, right? And they're all experts in peace and conflict resolution. So here's the proposal. And I'm calling it an Indian Union Mediation Service, which is technically what India is. It's an Indian Union of states. I mean, I've been around some of the Raj palaces in Jaipur and Udaipur and things, and it's very interesting, the old princely states, how what we call India came into being. You know, it was cobbled together by the British, actually. You know, we helped create it, and it's a legacy we've left, and I feel a kind of duty that Britain owes to help them through some of these conflicts that are residual. So what I'm proposing is that a professional and politically supported mediation service should be created under the auspices of the Indian Union, comprising recognised experts in mediation conflict prevention. Full members of the Indian Union, that is full states like Rajasthan, because it's a federal government, India, you see, like you know, the other states, the Punjab and so on, would be entitled to be full members of this. You know, I think it's ridiculous they don't have one yet, because given their history of Gandhi and non-violence, and all the great religions of India have stressed non-violence. I mean, it's central to the Brahmin's role in Hinduism. Ahimsa is, you know, is a sine qua non for becoming a Hindu pandit or a scholar of any kind, or a priest. And the same absolutely in Buddhism and Hinduism, which are the other great faiths. So there you are. The idea is you get a team of experts trained, available. Each state puts up a pool of 10, right? Body of panel of mediators. It's, you know, and each member state would then have a right to initiate mediations. Now, these are the full member states of the Indian Union. They're the different provinces. Assam is one, Goa, Gujarat, etc., Karnataka, Orissa, Nagaland. That's your one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so it would be able to be a full member of this thing, West Bengal. But then there are the Union Territories, which would also get full membership, which are those ones. And interestingly, Pondicherry is a Union Territory, so is Delhi, in fact. Mm-hmm. But they'd have their own team of mediators. This is the proposal. Now, what I'm also, and this is where it's kind of like, I think, potentially really exciting, is associate membership would be open to neighbouring countries. Okay, so that is Bhutan, Burma, China, Afghanistan, Ladakh, Nepal, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, and the Maldives. So, and it's really kind of calling the bluff. You know, if I was an Indian politician, I'd set this up tomorrow, because I think it's such a neat idea. It's calling the bluff of your neighbours and saying, look, we're setting up our mediation service for our troubled region, which is vast. We're the main power in the subcontinent, but we've got a tradition of peace and all that, so we're going to set one up for us. And you're welcome to have associate membership status, which means you have to chip in financially. There's a financial cost, you know, to run the thing. Each member state would donate a certain... my proposal is a proportion of their military budget, or their security budget. I'm advocating 1%, which is a minor amount to pay for actual peacemaking, given that peacemaking, resolving conflict, is much more cost-effective, as we've seen in Iraq, than actually fighting the war and then trying to rebuild the country. That's crippled America's economy and Britain's. We can't afford to go on using the military option. Non-violent dispute prevention and resolution is much more cost-effective on purely economic grounds, you know. And that's why I'm proposing this to the EU, which began as an economic idea. I'm saying peace is absolutely economically good sense, and also in the Indian context. So, you know, the thought of Pakistan and India ever going to another war, given that they're now nuclear powers and so on, is just horrendous, the amount of suffering and deaths and chaos and so on. Economically, it makes absolutely no sense. Much better that the Pakistanis are invited to join this as associate members. And I believe they would, actually. I mean, I used to teach at the Muslim College in London, and you know, I met a former foreign secretary of Pakistan at my time there, because I had quite a number of high-up students, one of whom is now the head of the Red Crescent in Afghanistan, for instance. I think Afghanistan would sign up to this. Taliban might not. Bin Laden might not. But, you know, this is an intergovernmental proposal. And then the mediation service could offer to mediate things like the Taliban conflict. I don't see a long-term solution militarily to that conflict on the Afghan frontier, you know, with Pakistan. I don't see a military solution to the Kashmir problem either. I think this is really, you know, and I'm saying this as a philosopher, logically, I've worked it out, this is the only way to go. It's called mediation and conflict resolution and dialogue, you know. And I'm not a politician, so I can just point this out to politicians. Now, the good news is that when I was in India and proposed this, a number of, you know, political leaders were there and sort of thought, well, that's quite a good idea. The problem with politics, of course, is that they think short term. They'll say that's a good idea 1 week to one party, and then they'll go off and talk to, you know, I don't know, the tank making companies and say, no, we need military solutions, you know, make your tanks and so on. So anyway, there's the proposal. You can look at it on the web there. It's about interstate disputes. And these do come up. You know, this would include between, say, Pakistan and India over Kashmir and so on, or between different states within the Indian Union. And it's also intrastate, so it's disputes within, like, Nagaland, between different disputes. And like in... There was all kinds of rioting in Mumbai, wasn't there? Between the indigenous sort of Mumbai people and then incomers coming in. And there were riots in the shanty towns about, because lots of people are flocking to the cities in India. And the locals were saying, we don't want you to come. Do you remember that? So those are the kinds of communal tensions, communal riots that this group would do. And
Maharashtrians versus non-Maharashtrians.
Yeah, that's what it was.
People from UP were being sidelined and attacked, from Bihar and UP.
Yes, that's right. And there was blows in the street and stuff. Yeah. So if this service was up and running, it would be there for dealing with these kind of disputes. Rather than just doing it on an ad hoc basis, when they break out, you go in a week later. The other thing that inspired me was the Christian riots. Was it Orissa? When the Christian Indian minority was being attacked by Hindus. And I talked to my Jain colleagues about this. And, you know, there was a nun raped, and there were several dozens of people killed, and hundreds of people were made refugees and stuff, if you recall. And I talked to my Jain friends what they thought was going on. And he said he thought, or in their circle, they knew that these anti-Christian riots were being whipped up by followers of the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party, in order to then create an anxiety and emergency sort of feeling to then get votes at the forthcoming election. And it was a deliberate tactic to stimulate sort of anxiety, which is a thing that fascist movements do. Historically, that's what they did in Italy, in Germany. You create instability, and you then blame the out-group. Now, those are allegations that were made by James. I mean, I can't substantiate them. If you had an Indian Union Mediation Service, they would deal with these kind of things. All I know is people were dying under horrific circumstances, you know, and I know one of the Hindu leaders was killed as well. I still don't know who did it. The mobs said a Christian had done it, you know. I practice epoche. I'm going back to my idea of suspension of judgment. I think our job as scholars is to help get this kind of thing set up, and then to do it absolutely impartially, you know, that it would find solutions and truth between these disputes. So that's another thing, the right of referral. It's all discussed here. I reckon you'd need a research office to deal with it, obviously, which would be staff. This is where the academics come in. You know, you'd need people trained in all the academic disciplines to actually make sense of these disputes. So they're so complex. People, you'd need translators involved, political scientists. I mean, why do we have universities like Oxford? Surely it's to generate knowledge. Well, then it needs to be applied in the real world. And one of the crucial things that the world needs right now is peace, you know, and non-violence. So let's get working on it, is what I say. And links with the religious organizations. Obviously, I ran this idea past Hindus, Muslims, you know, different representatives. There's loads in India who were keen. And I mean, it's very eclectic, as you can see from my list there. The Theosophical Society in India is quite important, in Adyar. Freemasonry in India was very important, and still is. You know, they should be involved. Also the tribal peoples. You know, and the Sufi tradition is important. This is interesting. I stayed at this conference next to the head of, he was the head of India's like equivalent to MI5, like the intelligence gathering body for the Indian government. And he was personally requested to take charge of the investigation into Rajiv Gandhi's assassination. Who had killed Rajiv Gandhi, blew him up, you know. And he personally was trusted by the government enough to actually investigate that, given a budget and told to get on with it. He spent 2 years and eventually discovered it was the Sri Lankan Tamil terrorist organisation who'd done it. And he was able to prove that forensically, exactly where it was and what links. And it was because Rajiv Gandhi was trying to mediate the conflict in Sri Lanka and was refusing to take the side of the Tamils. So they, in a fit of pique, blew him up. And he'd offered Indian troops to be peacemakers. You know, it's tragic. And especially in light of what's happening now, where the Tamil Tigers have finally been destroyed militarily, you know. I mean, they should, if they could, resurrect Rajiv Gandhi, you know, and bring him back. But anyway, this chap did that, and he published a book about it. I've got his details and everything. And now he's become a sort of peace advocate through spirituality and so on. And he just got back from a conference in Pakistan, organized by the Pakistani Sufi community, to which he'd been invited as the only Indian. He's a Hindu, this guy. Talking about, you know, Indian Hindu peacemaking and the role of Sufism in Islam and so on. So there are people doing this visionary work, you see. These are the sort of people that could run this mediation service. It's not for people in Britain to do. I'm just saying this is a good idea. I want to work on the European one myself. That's the kind of, it's all there. You can look on the website and it's all very exciting. Now I want to just, how are we doing for time here? I'm coming to the end, I promise. If you've got any questions, you know, in the middle, you can interrupt, but, or we can wait till the end. All I want to do really in the end is just give a few philosophical observations on all this, points arising, just things for future research or discussion. You know, this place might be a centre which can do some of this stuff in alliance with other colleges at the university or other academic centres. Firstly, I think it would be very interesting to see an in-depth study of the traditions of non-violence within Hinduism, actually to look at where that comes from, those teachings, and actually find some of the core texts. You know, it's a sort of a recognised fact of Ahimsa, but actually what are the teachings, you know, that nobody's done, so far as I know, the kind of the whole references within the different texts. So that would be exciting. Secondly, I think very exciting would be a study of Hinduism's relationship with other Indian faiths. Within Orthodox Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and so on, regarded as heretics, right, and Muslims. Now, where does that notion arise from? Who said, at what point within the evolution of the Hindu consciousness did this notion of heresy arise? And can it be deconstructed? Can it be transformed? Because one of the problems I've discovered as a philosopher of religions is that all these religious wars are always caused by one lot calling the other lot the heretics, right? And somehow I think we need to revisit the whole notion of heresy. After all, it means choice, the people that choose. You know, I think that if you're talking philosophically about truth, we shouldn't necessarily be calling people heretics. It doesn't really help the conversation. We should be guiding the conversation back to truth discourse rather than heresy versus orthodoxy. You know, that's just, and can I think Hinduism is subtle enough as a metaphysical system to do that, but it would require emphasizing different aspects of Hindu theology and letting some others go. Another thing that's needed, I think, is to re-examine the whole Hindu-Muslim relationship, because this is the core challenge for Indian thought and Indian politics and the fault line with Pakistan and also with Bangladesh to some extent. And, you know, there needs to be a reopening of discourse between Hindu philosophers and Muslim philosophers. Now, we know that the word Hinduism doesn't really exist. There's no such thing as Hinduism. There's Sanatan Dharma. There's the core truth. You know, that's their word for it. So really, we're not talking about Hindu-Muslim dialogue, we're talking about Sanatan Dharma and Islam. We're talking about ultimate, perennial truth and Islam. So that dialogue is needed. And within that context, one can talk about the enormous contribution by Indian culture and Hinduism to the evolution of Sufism, the Chistia and the other Sufi orders of the Indian subcontinent that, you know, arose in India at this contact between Indian mind and Muslim mind. You know, the Muslims invaded India, but the price of the conquest was Sufism, you know, which I think is an incredibly vibrant and amazing tradition, and influenced then, you know, in Iran and spread, you know, to the West, and great Sufi teachers. Now, scholars need to look at that transmission, exactly who, what, where, when Sufism came through those channels. Among the many things that the Hindus gave to the Muslims was, of course, the numeric system that we use in the West, the number system. And that excellent program on Islam and science at the moment, Professor Khalil from Surrey University, talking about Baghdad at its heart of mathematical genius in the 9th century, you know, they were looking at Hindu texts, they were translating Indian Sanskrit mathematical texts, they were taking the notion of the number zero, and then they were combining it with Greek mathematics and coming up with an algebra. Now this is, you know, this is the sort of thing that I think people should be talking about, rather than terrorist activities. You know, we should be rediscovering that dialogue, and it would be nice to hear it from the Hindu line, and you know, for the Hindus to reclaim their role in that and to say, well, did you enjoy those books we lent you, you know, 1,000 years ago? You know, get the dialogue going again. You know, rebuild the House of Wisdom in Baghdad. I mean, there was a great house of translation there, which used to, you know, they were studying Sanskrit and Arabic and Greek in the 9th century. Rebuild it, you know, rather than, we flattened the rest of Baghdad, might as well rebuild something worthwhile and go for it. That's what I think. Other thing is, of course, the Sikh community. I haven't spoken about them, but they are very important for the success of this piecework. And I've got significant links with the Sikh community. I've been to the Punjab a couple of times and spoken at the Guru Nanak University there. And also with the Namdaris, a particular branch of Sikhs who are dedicated to piecework. The Sikh movement arose out of the cusp between the Hindu and Islamic clash, you know, and very strongly influenced by Kabir and the Sufi traditions and so on. So I think they would want to join this conversation for peace. This moves me to my next point, which is, it's a philosophical point about pluralism and identity. I think the notion of people having one faith is actually outmoded now on this planet. We're in a globalistic world community. I think all these faiths belong to the human story, and that as mature people, we can say they're all our stories. You know, as Guru Nanak said, there is no Hindu nor Muslim. There's a seeker, there's a student, you know. I am both a Sikh and a Muslim and a Christian. And I think the more people that can stand up and say that, the more likely we're to get peace on this planet more quickly. It's if you stand up and say, no, I'm exclusively X or Y, and you're the enemy, that we're going to perpetuate this dualistic consciousness, right? Now, precisely that ability to have pluralistic identities was the original genius that created the concept of Sanatan Dharma in the first place. It's the genius that underlay Shankara's work. The diversity is illusory. There's only a unity, ultimately. And I think Hinduism has to reinvent itself and contribute to that higher order dialogue of seeking that transcendental unity, and in which different identities can coexist in paradoxical simultaneity. Okay, there isn't a conflict. There's diversity of identity. We all have multiple natures, personalities, and so on. And we should celebrate that. You know? What's wrong with it? And within my own work, my own sort of academic work, I find the only school of contemporary thought that can cope with this complexity of thought is that of transpersonal psychology, which can actually cope with the spiritual nature of man scientifically and begin to articulate a sort of mature vision of what human beings are. And so what I've been doing is marrying up transpersonal psychology with the traditions of psychohistory. Each of us carries a narrative, a story through our biography. We need to stop telling stories of hurt, blame, and revenge to each other. We've all been wounded. We've all done a bit of wounding, probably some more than others. But you know, we need to grow up. We need to reach a place where we can honour each other's stories. And so I call this the place of transpersonal psychohistory. It's like a place of healing is needed. And You know, I see this in the great texts of the philosophical traditions of India. Now, of course, there's a dark side, and I don't want to over-romanticise the role of religions. Up until the British outlawed human sacrifice, some Hindu communities were still practising human sacrifice, you know, up until the early 19th century. Kali, you know, the dark goddess, the kind of the violence within human beings. I mean, just as there's a light side within the Indian mind and the Hindu mind, there's a dark side, and there is violence, and there is, you know, human sacrifice, etc. Now, but that's been in all cultures. the Celts, you know, the Romans, the Greeks, the American Indians, they've all done this. I mean, what is Christianity based around apart from a sort of sacrificial myth? You know, transpersonal psychohistory can look at the dark side, look at where violence comes from, the phenomenology of violence that René Girard has looked at in his work on religion and violence and the sacred. You know, the desire to control, possess the other, to defeat them, to eat them, you know, that whole sort of nonsense, to be honest. But it, sadly, we have this animal streak in us, you know. So philosophically, the work is to educate people to kind of transcend that, which is what the work of the Brahmins was. And I think within transpersonal history, therefore, it's the reclaiming of our nobler narratives that's called for. And people like Jung, and who was, you know, a pioneer in this, but nowadays people like Ken Wilber or Saggioli, these transpersonal thinkers, can find the common light between these different traditions. Here's a thought. You probably know, but when I went to India recently, I was reminded why there are no temples to Brahma in India. You'd have thought there'd be lots, because he's the top god. You know, he's God, right? Really, the creator god. And there's temples to the creator god everywhere, all over the world. You know, in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, they all worship the creator god. You know, but there's only one temple to Brahma. Where is it? No, it's in Rajasthan, I believe. That's why I was kind of discovering it. I didn't actually go, but I looked it up. It's only one temple to Brahma. And the story is that Brahma, the very earlier, soon after creation, was going to a particular ritual sacrifice feast with his wife, Sarasvati. And he had to wait for her to get ready. And she was dressing, and she was with her attendants, and taking a very long time, and putting on the makeup and everything. Right? And he got cross, he got a bit angry, impatient, and sort of yelling up after her. Anyway, Sarasvati finally emerged, and she was very cross, and she cursed him and said, "You will only ever have one temple, ever, and it'll be here, commemorating this your naughtiness to me, the goddess, who is at least as old as you." And that's why there's only one temple to Brahma. So that's the story, the goddess cursed Brahma. Now, I thought this is very interesting, because I've been puzzling on it. And then I thought, well, what about, you see, Islam, the mosque, all the mosques of India, I think, are secretly temples to Brahma as the transcendent creator god. So Brahmas sneak them back in, you see, as churches and mosques. So I think theologically we can reconcile this whole dispute as just recognizing the power and the interplay of the divine as the divine leader. You know, God has had the last laugh here. So there's a thought which arose when I was there last. So in the clash of cultures, there can be a coexistence of cultures, and authenticity in one's own spiritual path doesn't depend on devaluating or disvaluing the other. This is such a stupid notion. Where's it arisen from? You know, I don't need to call you a heretic to define my orthodoxy. You know. Everybody has. I mean, the more free and open your mind, the more you're going to ask questions. I mean, there's a wonderful quote from Rumi who said, the person of disbelief, you know, the doubter, the kafir, whatever, is the person who hides their disbelief. You know, not the person who's honest about it and who actually uses their intellect to try and work out truth. I mean, that's surely the definition of real orthodoxy. So, just to conclude then, I think that what we need to replace the kind of dialogue of violence with is the dialogue of peace between religions, between spiritualities. I think Hinduism is well equipped to do that. I think India could be a showcase, if only they could kind of get their act together. Adopt this mediation service or something like it, you know, solve the internal problems and act as a beacon to the rest of the world, you know, which desperately needs peace. And I think we can then replace dialogue about violence with dialogue about enlightenment, which is the great gift of Indian thought and philosophy, moksha, you know, enlightenment, the goal of philosophy. And I've coined this concept of enlightenments, plural, in my own work as a scholar. I've written a book, which I'm going to show you here, called Enlightenments, plural. And I think, and what I've tried to do in this book is look at teachings on enlightenment in different faiths, Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, you know, Christian, etc. And then say we need to have a dialogue about, you know, who's, not whose is better, but what's the lineage, where does it come from, okay? What's the genealogy of their view of enlightenment? So this is my kind of publication thing. There's a thing there on the Middle East thing I talked about. I'm also a poet. This thing, Sophiophobia, is really interesting. That's about the fear of wisdom, which I think is operative in society. The philosophers love wisdom, but an awful lot of people seem to be afraid of it or hate it. And I think, you know, the people that assassinate Gandhi and Martin Luther King and so on, they're Sophiophobes. And I think a lot of our institutions are. So I do recommend that. I'm hoping Penguin will bring that out. That's going to be fun when it comes out. But this one, Enlightenments, is the one I'm talking about. This is, I've not seen any, well, I mean, there's a couple of people who've done something similar, but nobody's done it rigorously and academically. And this is only a first draft, really. I ran a seminar on it in Rajasthan, and it, you know, there were people around the table from all different traditions. It was great fun. So I think that's the way to go, really. Eventually the picture comes up. It's quite slow here, this website, isn't it? Have you noticed that? Or is it
it
is quite slow, isn't it? The other thing that I recommend people, that I want to tell you about, is this Universal Calendar of Saints and Sages. This, I've had great fun writing over the last few years. You can buy dictionaries of Christian saints, but you can't buy dictionaries of all of them. The Oxford University Press does a great dictionary of saints, and as a teacher, I usually do a saint of the day. Before I begin the lesson, I say it's St. Agnes's Day or St. Mark's Day, and I tell the story of the saint. What I wanted was a textbook with all the different religions in, including the Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, and so on. And there wasn't one, so I had to write it. And here it is. And it's got a column for every day of the year for all the traditions that are listed, you know, all the religions of the planet, and including the secular ones and, you know, the scientists and so on. That's why it's saints and sages. And that's kind of interesting. And within Islam, you know, I've chosen broadly across the range. Now, just final thoughts, then we can have a discussion, is the Hindu-Muslim cusp, the frontier there, theologically, is very important, because it's this split between the pagan religion and the revealed religion. There's a philosophical discussion needed here about, you know, indigenous religions that arise, and that's something I've specialised in, like Aboriginal religions, the traditional indigenous religions of Europe, but also within India, you know, the indigenous religions, the tribal religions, are the sort of grassroots of what later grew into Hinduism. Yeah? And I mean, Hinduism doesn't have a founder as such, whereas Judaism and Islam have sort of particular founders. Christianity obviously does, Buddhism does. And I think maybe this is one of the things about what a heresy is. It's when one particular sage comes along and says, my lot's the best ever, my lineage from now on is a whole new thing, and it replaces and supersedes everything else. The Hindu spirit, on the contrary, is here's my wisdom. It's within an eternal lineage. It hopefully is useful, but it's not claiming to supersede everything, you know. And I think that's the difference between the pagan or indigenous spiritual path and the revealed path. And that is a dialogue that's needed at the highest level. Because I think when it comes to the status of revealed texts like the Quran or the Gospels or whatever, you know, there's claims of absolutism going on there that the average Hindu finds very difficult. Because for him or her, all the texts are sacred, you know. There's another thing, though, which is that Hinduism itself claims revealed status as well. Hinduism has within it revealed texts. So, in a sense, maybe Hinduism could bridge this split between the pagan or non-revealed religions and the revealed ones. Maybe within Hindu theology is locked away the secret of what that means, actually, psychologically. What is the link between revelation and inspiration, for instance? There's a continuum, you know? In the old Druid schools of Western Europe, there was revelation. To be a Druid meant to be able to receive divine wisdom, and Taliesin and the other great bards of Britain wrote poetry from that place, you know. What's the difference between that and revelation in the Hindu tradition or within the Islamic context? I think that as a planet we need to start having those conversations at a level of maturity and mediate, in a sense, this war between revealed religions and natural religions, you know. There's something very important to be done there theologically. I think the contribution Hinduism can make is in theology, actually. Again, this paradox of mediating between God as a unity and God as a trinity, which is the long quarrel between Islam and Christianity and Judaism, you know. Hinduism has the secret, actually, which is both and. It's as simple as that. You know, the divinity is, of course, a trinity and a unity. And because of the genius of the Hindu mind coming up with maths of an advanced kind, you can't do mathematics without the number 3 and the number 1 and the number 0 and all of the numbers, you know. So it's like we're living in a theologically impoverished culture as a globe where we're all fighting over which number we favour. I mean, how primitive is that, you know? To the Indian mind, that is just very unsophisticated, do you know what I mean? It's like ridiculous. It's all energy, which can take the form of two-ness or three-ness or oneness or whatever. And I think the other thing that Hinduism has to offer, which is incredibly important, is the goddess tradition. It's the only one of the great religions on the planet that's kept the sacred feminine alive. It's kept the goddess there up front, you know. No kind of ifs and buts, hiding it in the cupboard like the Sufis do or the Christian Gnostics or whatever. You know, it's there. The goddess is powerful. And so I think that conversation's needed, because a lot of these conflicts and wars are men fighting for egotism and power and status. And really, they should just be servants of the universal goddess. That's what the Hindu sage would say. And submit properly to the real, you know, authority here, which is kind of Sarasvati. And that leads me to my final point, which is I've coined a word to replace terrorism, which I think is an outmoded conversation, and based on this false philosophy of exclusivism, right? We should replace that with joyism, right? Which is my radical revolutionary phrase. And so I've published, you know, an essay here on joyism as a path. You'll find it in this selected essays thing. Anyway, I'll stop there, you know, and, you know, any questions, really?
Thank you very much. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we've got 8 minutes, 10 minutes, 10 minutes for discussion, and then we can carry on after that, of course, but
right.
People have to go at 3:30.
Any questions? You go first.
Yeah. Thank you. For the lecture, I'm just wondering the proposal that you're making for India.
Yeah.
Is it just here, or have you made it to the government?
Not yet in a formal basis. No,
okay.
I have not yet.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I would, you know, I'm kind of intending to, but I haven't. I've had some. Like I said, it's been, you know, I'm working on several fronts at once, and
yeah.
You know, working as a full-time academic teacher and so on. So
I think it's
yeah.
a fantastic proposal.
Yeah.
The one question I would have
yeah.
is, you know, within an intra-national conflict,
yes,
you know, bringing in mediators from
yeah.
within that nation itself, would it be?
Could be problematic.
Yeah.
So what you're talking here about intranational.
Yeah. For example,
yeah.
I mean,
like
the Indo-Naga conflict.
Yes.
The Nagas, they've been, you know, fighting for independence.
Right.
And so if we propose that there should be mediators from within the Indian nation state.
Yeah, but what about if they came from Kerala and a different part of the Union territory?
Yeah.
That's the proposal.
Yeah, but the you see, the position of the Indian government is any solution must be within the purview of the Indian constitution.
Yeah, and the Nagas who are fighting want total independence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
well, so what you're yes, this is the way that the Indian Union Mediation Service would be set up, right, would be autonomous of whichever government happened to be ruling in Delhi at the time. Okay,
oh,
so you'd have a standing panel of professional mediators appointed directly by the states, right? And whoever took over power in Delhi as the national government wouldn't have the power to sack them. So that's the first thing, it would be autonomous, right? And I think, I mean, what you're saying is very interesting. I think that that's a question about you know, loyalty to the constitution of India, isn't it?
Yeah.
Presumably there are mechanisms within the constitution. I mean, Ambedkar helped write that constitution, didn't he, I believe? And you know, I met the chap at Cambridge who was his secretary at the time. He was a Buddhist, in fact, Ambedkar. You know, I mean, there are clauses, are there not, for rewriting the constitution, amendments and stuff like that?
Yeah, yeah, there are, but, you know, it's...
So that could be negotiable within a within the framework of an Indian Union Mediation Service, you know. Like, I mean, if a bit of Nagaland wanted autonomy, like Bhutan, say, why... I mean, I think nothing would be ruled out of order within the work of the Union Mediation Service. And it would be totally confidential, and it wouldn't be watched over by the politicians from Delhi. It would have, for it to work, it would have to be have its own autonomy, you see. And it might recommend, look, that bit of that territory should go off and become an autonomous region, you know. It might, I think it should have that power to recommend that. Of course, the real politic of the real, you know, stuff might then say, well, sorry, you can't have that. But it's a good, no, it's a good point, yeah.
I'm also worried about funding of these things and some practical things, but there's in the 2 minutes that we got left, let me play
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
Yeah.
There was Africa, and what happens if say like tribal identities, people's tribal identities are terribly important for them. We could say that this we've had this universalism and this perennial philosophy, and there's been a strong reaction against all that. And that's the reaction has been because people's feel that their identity is very much rooted in the stories of their tribe, their group. My story is part of the story of my particular historical thing, whatever it is. And so,
so don't bother. Is that what you're saying?
So don't bother.
just become a folklore expert and then go round and record all the stories.
So I've got a colleague in Nottingham. He says we should. He thinks we should replace dialogue with mutual suspicion.
Is he working in that Centre for Theology and Religious Studies?
Yeah.
It's quite a Roman Catholic centre, isn't it?
He's Anglican, this guy.
Quite Christocentric, anyway.
Yeah, it is. That's. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to everything you're saying, really, Thomas. But I'm thinking.
Got
to
see the other side.
We have to recognise those tribalisms and those kind of as being authentic and legitimate desires for human beings.
Well, that's sort of related to this last question, isn't it? Really, because that dispute is about tribalism in a bigger sense. And, and all these disputes are, you know.
Yeah.
Now, my position is both and. Right. I mean, I've studied, for instance, in detail the Celtic tribes, who were great warring tribes all the time. I'm involved in the Irish-British dispute and mediation there as well. You see, I didn't go into all that. And I live in Wales, so I've looked in detail at the Celtic tribal disputes, and they lived in tribal structures. But in every tribe, there were several, there were one or two sort of people who transcended mere tribalism. They were known as the Druid caste. Right? And they were trained, it took them 20 years to train themselves out of mere... you know, subservience to the immediate ego of the tribal identity. And Druids were welcomed whatever tribe they went to. They transcended the tribal divisions, you see. And just as Gandhi was, for instance, I mean, he transcended the simplistic divides of Hindu or Muslim. And I mean, he went and fasted to death to help the Muslims in Calcutta at the end of his life. And, you know, I mean, I and Plato, you know, and the Greek philosophers stood for the possibility of universal wisdom beyond the city-state, beyond the mere cult of the worship of the particular goddess of your temple.
Mm.
That's what Socrates died for, you know. Mm. So I'm with the philosophers on this one.
Mm.
And I think that, I think it's both and. I think you have to respect the tribe, but only up to a certain point.
Mm.
And I think we have too much in our culture, for instance, it's football teams and football tribes. You know, we have thugs regularly on a Saturday go and beat each other up with bottles at night because their team lost. And I mean, that's kind of like the national religion of Britain now, and it's, I'm ashamed of it, to be honest, you know, because we have to grow out of that stuff.
Mm.
And I think as a planet, I think you have to decide whether you're standing up for universalism and peace and reconciliation between the tribalisms, or whether you're going to just promote one of the teams, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's crunch time. And I've spent 25 years studying all the teams, you know, and all the tribes in terms of religions. A bit like that vicar who's going around the world in 80 faiths. You know,
I've done it
as a scholar.
Yeah.
And I think that you can be on everybody's side. My position on the Gaza-Israel war, as I've said, I've gone on record, is I'm on both sides simultaneously. You know, I have many Israeli friends and many Palestinian friends. And I can hear both their narratives. And in the work of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for the Middle East, I'm literally on both sides simultaneously. You can call me a traditional Anglican if you want. Which is the fudge, but that, you know, it's a necessary fudge because it's about peace.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's my tribe.
Well, thank you, Thomas. I think we should. You're very welcome to stay, but we have to formally wind up now. So thanks for coming all this way to share your thoughts with us, and I hope you'll be able to pursue some of these ideas on your own. So thanks again, Thomas.
Well, you can always contact me through the internet. You know, I've got this website that. It's currently being upgraded, but it's there. And it's simply educationaid.net. If you want to contact me, just type that in. It's educationaid.net. And then the details are all there. There's my personal email and stuff like that. And this is the latest newsletter. But yeah, I'm always happy to hear from people and continue the dialogue. So thank you.
So thanks for coming, everybody, and do leave your name with the secretary and where they can contact you, because she can let you know of future kind of events. You know.
Okay. What's this Centre for Mission Studies that you two are at? Yeah.
No one quite knows. It's undergoing a transformation.
Does it have a website or something?
Yeah, it is.
Right.
I think they want to make it into Oxford Centre for Global Christianity or something.
Is it?
Because there's Hindu studies and Islamic studies, so they're trying to...
They're trying to be the Christian studies thing.
Christian studies, something like that.
Interesting. Well,
which department of Brooks are you in?
I'm at the School of Architecture, but I've taken the class on the disaster aid and climate change.
Oh, I see. You're okay.
Well, good luck.
Thanks. Mm. I was interested in your talk, or the idea of mediation. I don't study conflict resolution, but I study sort of what I would call structural violence in terms of like a long-term sitting.
The bureaucracy
that doesn't take into account these other worldviews, other types of life, things like that. So, settlements and missionaries, people coming in. And
paradigm clash, kind of worldview clash.
Absolutely, with a clear power behind one particular worldview that sort of imparts a certain way of being on other people. So I would say that would be structural violence, right? And I think maybe this mediation idea actually might have a lot of clout
in development
discussions.
Yes.
Discussions about aid. I think that maybe even potentially even more than these like huge political conflicts, these smaller
sort of resource disputes.
Exactly.
Who gets to mine which bit of land?
Exactly.
Stuff.
Who owns what land? How people
it would
get
be
their healthcare delivered? Just small things.
Well, I mean, feel free to take it away and run with it. I mean, there is in Canada. There is a Truth and Reconciliation Commission mm-hmm. been set up, and they were advertising a job, and I nearly thought of applying.
Yeah,
which
no,
is looking at Indigenous yeah. rights and stuff.
They Canada's very progressive in
yeah.
terms of reconciliation with Inuit.
Yeah.
yeah.
And they're also trying to set up a museum for human rights that I thought might be quite fun to do in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
So even thinking of, because I'm sort of transatlantic, I can live in either country. But in Alaska, I don't know what, you know, you're American, are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So here we are. Look, the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission
yeah,
is already up and running, and it's looking at India stuff, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
So you could contact them and say, you're working in Alaska. Can you borrow something or, you know, build bridges with them?
Yeah. Now, I know some people that work with them because it has a lot to do with relocating people
right.
In the north, which was quite traumatic.
What's the situation like with, I mean, is the climate change that big up in Alaska? I mean,
well, it's funny when you work with small tribes, actually, because the numbers are quite different than when you're talking about places in India, Bangladesh, or
right.
Tuvalu, even. So there are 5 villages, basically, in Alaska that need to relocate because of erosion and flooding, the biggest of which has 600 people. So those are the numbers. They're quite small.
Right, but it's still, for them, it's huge. It's their whole village
mm-hmm.
and stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, who pays for that?
And what? So, and where people have to go. So in
right.
the village I work in, there's prediction is 10 to 15 years before the island's uninhabitable. And the first proposition from the government was to relocate people into urban environments because it's
right.
cheaper and it's...
But they don't want that. They want another...
It's unanimous, actually.
It's a village. They want another village.
Mm-hmm, and, you know...
Are they living a traditional Inuit lifestyle to some extent?
To some extent. About
yeah.
I think it's about 60% of calories come from hunting and gathering.
Set one up in the States, you know, with Alaska. Put it into your PhD. Can you do that? Can you do action research type stuff?
I do. I am studying and working with how the cross-cultural communication between tribal leaders and bureaucrats working on solutions for this problem. So, I mean, it's possible, yeah.
Mm.
But
well, that's very exciting.
But it's
if I can help in any way, you know.
Yeah.
One thing
yeah,
I have
no,
done.
Yeah, no, really, because
mm.
it's, yeah, it's, people are just at
mm.
sort of a stopgap in the conversations, so they're not happening at the moment. They're wrong.
One thing I did, which is on that website of books that I published, is I did a dictionary of terms for peacemaking and mediation.
Mm.
And I put in all the American Indian languages.
Oh, that's interesting.
But I don't think Inuit is in there, you know. So if I mean, that is possibly a good place to sort of move the dialogue on, is get representatives of the different communities actually sharing their vocabulary, core vocabulary. You know, what's your word for peace, mediation, truth, reconciliation, you know. Write it down, and what's yours, and that's contrast,
mm-hmm.
you know, because in the subtlety of the terms is a whole cultural lineage that
mm-hmm.
they're not listening to each other, and this whole the secret of the whole work is listening and hearing. I mean, you guys very politely listened to me, you know, you've hopefully learned something and, you know, take it away. You could have been shouting and, you know, and that's kind of like what these people are doing to each other, you know. To me, the whole art of civilization is actually listening.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting in the Semitic context, the notion of the Shema, the prayer of Israel, hear, O Lord, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. It's called the Shema. And the first word, hear, O Israel, listen. You know, and in the Hebrew tradition, the prophet's always listening to God, you know. And that, so that, you know, but listening to the God within the other. Are they listening to the God of the Palestinians, you know?
Mm.
That's the... And now the bureaucrats. I mean, it's a sociological thing, isn't it? Bureaucracies don't listen to individuals. Or, and they can't understand each other's traditions.
Right.
It's also a religious dispute, because the Inui may stick to some native, you know, paths.
And certainly have a different relationship with the land in which you inhabit, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, I would say, has a
yeah.
spiritual component.
Sure. Yeah, but, you know, good luck with that, because that comes out of a long sort of 200 or 300 years of American bureaucracy in Washington
ideology.
Encroaching on
yeah.
Indian territory and, you know, the Trail of Tears. And I've worked with the Cherokee people in Oklahoma
mm-hmm.
Doing workshops on this stuff. And And that's why I was emphasizing the importance of this dialogue between the indigenous cultures and the revealed ones. Nowadays, it's the global political power centers that are the new revealed religions. Their core text is Machiavelli, found the insane, verses, and these little people don't matter,
yeah.
They're just sort of pushing it out of the way.
That's
I think they matter hugely.
But that's why when you say universalism, I think it causes people to shudder sometimes, because universalism is interpreted as being just kind of the dominant.
That's, I think, hopefully enough has come over from my talk that you realise that's
sure,
not what I'm
sure,
talking about.
Sure.
But you
can understand.
Well, that's where some of that suspicion has
that,
come from.
Right.
Some of the suspicion has come from that, yeah.
Right.
That's a whole kind of dialogue there, isn't it? And that's the sort of anti-globalisation movement take on this, is that it's about. But I advocate what I call trans-globalism, of course, being a transpersonalist. I'm neither a sort of globalist nor an anti-globalist. I think globalism is inevitable. It's happened, but what we don't want is just McDonaldization of global culture. We've got the lowest common denominator at the moment.
Mm.
We need sophisticated trans-globalism, where each culture shares its wisdom and its enlightenment.
Mm.
And the elders of the Inuit community can sit down with the elders of the Hebrew community or the Anglican community or whatever and share in wisdom.
Mm.
And then we can build a sort of culture of peace from the grassroots up. Is where I'm coming from. So, anyway, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right. Excellent.